Thanks for listening to Press Play. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film award season, I have a podcast just for you. It's called The Treatment, and it's hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis really goes beyond the simple plot outline to understand what inspires the people who make these movies, the actors, the filmmakers, the producers. So check it out, The Treatment, on KCRW's iTunes page.
The presentation of the awards based on official results of the economy run. First place winner for all cars entered in the standard classifications for actual miles per gallon, the Studebaker champion with a pace-setting record of 27.82 actual miles per gallon. Studebaker is the dependable economy car of the year.
Miles per gallon is becoming a bit of an anachronism in the age of the electric car, but are the electric cars of the future about to become a thing of the past? We'll talk about what could replace them in just a moment. One of the pluses of electric cars, zero carbon emissions. But global warming is not just about carbon dioxide. Now it's also about methane. On Monday, a study came out showing that there's 60% more methane in the air above Los Angeles than the government had thought. Using sensors on Mount Wilson, scientists say about 430,000 tons of methane are being released across the region each year from landfills, gas pipelines, farms, even the La Brea tar pits. There is still a lot more carbon dioxide being released, but the EPA says methane can trap 25 times more heat. The biggest source of methane? Oil and gas production. Today, President Obama announced a plan to get oil and gas producers to do a better job of controlling the amount of methane they release into the atmosphere. And here to tell us more is Coral Davenport. She's energy and environment reporter for the New York Times. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline. Great to be with you.
Nice to have you. Well, tell us exactly what the EPA announced today.
So the EPA kind of announced that they're going to make an announcement. This had been widely expected and anticipated. The EPA said that by this summer, they're going to put forth proposed regulations on leaks of methane from oil and gas production. This is going to be the first ever federal regulations on methane. This is a really big deal because, as you said, although methane is not as famous a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide, it only makes up about 9% of total U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. It traps heat at 25 times the level of carbon dioxide. So even though there's less of it in the atmosphere, it's powerful stuff. And so this is the administration saying they're going to move forward, and for the first time ever, they're getting started with writing regulations to rein that in. They said the plan is to put forward a set of aggressive regulations that could cut methane leaks 40 to 45% in the next 10 years.
How hard is it to plug those leaks?
Well, it's not nearly as hard as it is to go after a lot of the CO2. The leaks come from several different places in the oil and gas production system. They come from the well. This is exacerbated by the process known as fracking, hydraulic fracturing. So they come out of the ground, but they also leak in different points along the production and transportation system. So they kind of imagine, you know, it leaks from valves, from pipes, from storage systems. So really what's needed, all the equipment that's needed to stop those leaks already exists. And there are a lot of facilities that don't have any leaks. Overall, the administration is saying, you know, all the technology is there to do this. What hasn't happened so far is government oversight to make sure that industry is doing everything they can to use that technology, to use those sealants, to make sure they don't have leaks from pipes. So, it's oversight and work, but all the technology is there.
Right. And they're saying, well, we're using that technology because we want to sell that methane, and that maybe these burdensome requirements and regulations could actually slow down the industry progress in reducing methane emissions.
That is the argument of the oil and gas industry. They point out methane is the primary component of natural gas. And so if you are a natural gas producer, a fossil fuel producer, the argument from industry is, look, that's stuff we want to sell. That's our product. So it's in our own interest to make sure that it doesn't leak, make sure that it doesn't escape. You know, we want to be able to sell it. So, you know, putting in a bunch of regulations, adding in all this oversight, forcing us to report what we're doing isn't even necessary. But the fact is that, you know, you talked about the study that came out this week about all the methane just in the Los Angeles area. A study came out last year in the journal Science that found methane is leaking from oil and gas production sites at about 50% higher a rate than was previously understood. The industry says, oh, you know, we're motivated to do this anyway, but there's a lot of methane leaking, and, you know, at the moment, oil and gas production is booming and is expected to continue to grow a great deal. So there's potential for a lot more of this to come.
So, as you say, a lot of it, most of it comes from oil and gas production, but what about agriculture, specifically cattle?
Yes. This is a real thing. Cow manure and straight-up cow flatulence are both significant contributors to methane in the atmosphere. And so every time you start hearing about federal regulations on methane, all the farmers get worried. Everyone says, oh, this is going to be about controlling cows. At the moment, there are no plans for this. However, the administration is looking at other sources of methane. The number one source is oil and gas production. We may see regulations that address cow manure, that require technology to dispense of cow manure, to process it in a different way, to capture that methane. That is not covered under the announcements today, but overall, across the spectrum, the administration is looking hard at different sources of methane, different ways to regulate it, and this is of a piece with the Obama administration's broader efforts to crack down on global warming, on greenhouse gases from every sector of the economy. So in this case, it's oil and gas. We probably will eventually see something addressing agricultural methane. And, of course, we're also seeing regulations on greenhouse gases from cars, from power plants. So this is a very strategic step-by-step agenda that we're seeing on broadly on climate change.
And I guess, well, Republicans don't like it because they don't like that agenda. But environmentalists don't seem to be very happy with the announcement today either. Do they just not think it goes far enough?
They don't think it goes far enough. Exactly. Environmentalists complain about a very specific part of the regulation. The regulation they're going to announce is going to be focused on new or future oil and gas production facilities. It will not address existing facilities. So anything new that will be built will have to comply with new sets of regulations so that there won't have those leaks. Environmentalists say, well, look, all these leaks are happening from existing facilities. That's happening now. The administration says we're going to work with industry, create voluntary standards for existing facilities. My bet is, it's not just my bet, under the Clean Air Act, the law of the Clean Air Act, which the administration is working under, once you put forward regulations on new or future facilities, that triggers a legal requirement to eventually have to regulate existing facilities. So this is looked at as kind of the first step in eventually getting to that legal requirement to regulate existing facilities. That may not happen for several years. Environmentalists are unhappy. They want to see, you know, all points addressed right now.
Coral Davenport, energy and environment reporter for the New York Times. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Madeline.
Okay, so methane, carbon dioxide, both byproducts of our car culture. Well, some car companies are making cars that produce zero emissions, cars that run on another gas, hydrogen. Honda announced today it will start selling a hydrogen-powered car in California next year, joining Toyota and Hyundai. It's the first real push to bring this technology, which has been around for a while, into the mainstream. These fuel cell cars are in direct competition with electric cars as the alternative energy-powered car of the future. Aaron Robinson is the executive editor at Car and Driver magazine. He's in Detroit at the auto show. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Even though you only call me when you want to discuss cow flatulence, I'm happy to be here.
Okay, we're going to leave that well enough alone and talk about this new Honda FCV, which was unveiled at the auto show in Detroit. What does it look like?
Well, it's a very spacey sort of, what would you call it, an interstellar landing pod. It's really a concept at this point. They haven't showed us the final version of what this car is going to look like, but clearly, they're reaching for the stars with the styling of this car.
Okay. And so this will be available in California next year? It's not just a concept?
That's right, and it's going to be joining a couple of other cars, the Toyota Mirai, which we saw at the Los Angeles Auto Show, yep. as well as a Hyundai fuel cell vehicle. So there's going to be several to choose from.
Well, why would I want to choose one of these, a hydrogen-powered car, over an electric car?
Well, there are a few advantages. Basically, a hydrogen-powered car is an electric car. It just uses hydrogen to make the electricity that is stored on board rather than power from the grid. And the advantages are that you drive it pretty much like a regular car, and when you need to fuel it up, you pull up to a pump, just as you do today, stick the nozzle in, and it fuels the car in about 3 to 4 minutes, and off you go. And you're getting about 250 to 300, maybe up to 350 miles on a tank of hydrogen versus an electric car where you're kind of tethered to the charge cord. You may only be getting 65 to 100 miles unless you have a very expensive Tesla, and you're quite limited in what you can do. And if you are getting low, you can't just pull into the nearest fuel station. You actually have to go find a charging station. So there are several advantages to the fuel cell that are driving car companies to look at that technology over just straight battery electric vehicles.
Although finding one of those fuel stations might be a little difficult.
That's true, although here in California, we are lucky that the state has committed to radically increasing the number of hydrogen stations, and the state of California is committed to spending $20 million a year through 2023, and when it's all said and done, we should have about 100 hydrogen stations, which obviously will be concentrated in the big cities, so it won't be so difficult to get hydrogen soon.
Elon Musk says, he actually used the word silly. He calls hydrogen fuel cells silly because they're hard to make and hard to store. The hydrogen itself is hard to store.
Well, yeah, he actually called them fuel cells. And I think that's a bit of a stretch. I mean, Elon has, you know, staked his reputation and his fortune on a certain technology, which is the plug-in electric vehicle. So, of course, he's not going to be jumping up and down in favor of this technology. Fuel cells require a heck of a lot of R&D investment, and this is something that Tesla just is incapable of, so they can't just switch gears in the middle and go with this new technology. So they're actually a little bit concerned that the rest of the industry, Toyota and Honda and Volkswagen and General Motors and all these guys with very deep pockets, are now kind of leaving behind, although not really completely, battery electric vehicles and now looking at hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. And so, you know, Elon's, he does have a point. There are technical issues with fuel cell vehicles, but he's also kind of against the wall to show that his technology is superior to this kind of now new fascination for the auto industry.
Well, but there's other companies, and they haven't doubled down on just the one technology. They have both. Chevy unveiled the Bolt at the Detroit Auto Show, which isn't that an all-electric battery?
That's absolutely correct. And really what's happening is that the auto industry is saying there's not going to be one solution, that there's going to be multiple solutions. They're placing a lot of bets. They don't know exactly which one's going to win out. Perhaps none will win out. I mean, if you go back to the invention of the car at the turn of the last century, there were all kinds of ideas about how to run the car because the car hadn't really been invented yet. And we're kind of at that stage now because in 40 or 50 years, we don't really know which of these technologies is going to win. So everybody's placing their bets as widely as possible because they don't want to be caught with nothing when one technology wins over another.
Well, fuel cells, though, have been around for a long time, many decades. So why are they now the hot thing at the Detroit Auto Show in 2015?
In fact, the Apollo astronauts took fuel cells to the moon, but they were different fuel cells, much more expensive, obviously much heavier. And the idea of making it small enough and, most importantly, cheap enough to put in a mainstream automobile, that's the cutting edge of the technology. That's the big challenge. And also, you have to do it in a car that will be used in desert heat, in Minnesota freezing temperatures. It has to operate like today's cars, which means you've got to be able to turn it on and go down the driveway instantly. So those are just some of the challenges of getting this technology to work. Plus, there's an awful lot of precious metal in these fuel cells, namely platinum, and it's very expensive. And trying to reduce the cost, that's a big challenge, too, for the companies working on it.
Well, especially now that gas is so cheap.
Well, and that's another problem, is that it's thanks to a lot of people using less fuel and buying more efficient cars, and also the fact that we're producing a lot more oil in the United States now, as well as the rest of the world, fuel is you know, epically cheap at the moment. And that's kind of dimming the consumer's appetite for these cars, but it almost doesn't matter because the auto industry is under the regulatory gun to produce low and zero emission vehicles in the very near future, and right now, in fact. And so they have to produce these vehicles, whether the consumers are clamoring for them or not. And there will always be a certain segment of the consumers who want it just because they want it. But, you know, the mass body of buyers, yes, they're looking at, you know, $2 a gallon gasoline and saying, why do I need this?
And we don't know how much this Honda FCV is going to cost, right?
No, but if you look at what the other companies are charging, they're all the cars are around $50,000 to $60,000 if you go in and plunk down the money. Most, if not all, of the people who are going to get these cars are going to get them on leases because the lease terms are very favorable. For example, the Hyundai fuel cell vehicle is $499 a month. And that includes all the maintenance, and it actually includes all the hydrogen. You don't actually even have to pay for the fuel. So it's a pretty, you know, pretty good deal if you're kind of looking at a mid-sized sport utility. That's kind of right in the range of what you're going to spend to lease one of these vehicles. So that's most likely what people are going to do, are going to lease these things.
All right, Aaron. Well, thank you. Have fun in Detroit.
Well, I always do, Madeline.
That's Aaron Robinson, executive editor at Car and Driver magazine. Does that interest you, what he just said about the Hyundai, about hydrogen fuel cars in general? Or do you think the infrastructure needs to catch up before you dive in? Call us 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. And coming up, do you think you could pass the GED? It's gotten a lot harder, and now few people who take it pass it. That story is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The GED is not what it used to be. The reputation of the high school equivalency degree has lost a lot of its meaning over the years, and many employers now just don't think it's as good as a high school diploma. So the test makers decided to revamp it, to make the test more difficult and to get it in line with the new Common Core education standards. But did they make it too difficult? That's what education reporter Matt Collette wanted to find out when he sat down to take the test recently, and he joins us on the line to talk about that. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, before we get to your test results, and yes, we will get to your test results, tell us about these changes. The GED administrators decided that they needed to modernize the test. Why?
This is the first time the GED has been updated since its last revamp in 2002, and it's actually a response to the idea that the GED was just sort of becoming too easy. People, particularly employers and schools, weren't seeing it as being equivalent to getting a high school education anymore, and sort of it was just becoming less and less reliable a measure. So the administrators of the GED needed to update it, to come up with a new alternative. They also needed to bring it in line with the Common Core, so
right.
That also motivated the test.
Who are the GED administrators?
So up until, from 1942 up until the last year, the GED was administered by a nonprofit called the ACE, the American Council on Education. But last year, they paired up with a testing giant, Pearson, and now it is sort of run as a partnership. They're the GED testing service.
And so that's a for-profit company, Pearson.
They're a for-profit company, yeah. They're one of the big three designers and developers of standardized tests for schools and universities sort of all over the country.
And so you pay money to take the GED.
Yeah, the GED costs on average across the country about $120. In California, it costs $140.
Oh my gosh, that's a lot.
It really is, and particularly if you've got to take the test again, if you're not going to pass.
Well, yeah, so is there some motivation on the part of Pearson to make it harder so that people have to retake it and pay more money?
It certainly looks that way, but that's not what they're saying. They're saying that the test is, one, more expensive because they're changing how they're administering it. Now it's being administered on computers instead of at site, sort of across schools, colleges, the way you might take the SAT. Mm-hmm. Now you go to a GED's test center and you'd take the test. You'd go in, you wouldn't bring your phone, you'd sort of be cut off from the world for about 7 hours at a computer. You'd take notes on a whiteboard so you couldn't actually smuggle any information about the test out to pass it on to somebody else.
7 hours?
It's about 7 hours. There are four tests, each more than 90 minutes long. There's a couple of breaks. When you take the test on a computer, the test runs the break sort of automatically. A countdown clock for 10 minutes starts, and then the test starts again automatically. So if you're not back from the bathroom or grabbing some water, the test is rolling on without you.
Oh my gosh. Show no mercy. But I guess they're trying to cram in 4 years of high school into that 7 hours.
Yeah, and that's sort of the nature of it. You're cramming in 4 years of high school, so math, English, social studies, science, into one marathon testing session.
What's the success ratio?
This year, about 250,000 people took the test, and 86,000 of them passed. So less than a third of people are passing that test, which is a pretty strong decrease from the rates in the previous years. Particularly in 2013, we saw some of the highest pass rates. Almost 600,000 people passed the test that year, partially because people knew the test was going to get harder. So groups that work with high school dropouts were pushing everybody to pass that test, sort of saying, it's going to get harder. This is your chance to finish this test.
Okay, so who are the defenders of making it harder besides Pearson?
So Pearson is saying that they got a lot of pressure from both employers, and these are sort of the middle-level jobs, not something that you could just go, not sort of working behind the counter at a cashier, but something where you need sort of some basic skill in addition to mostly sort of showing up for your job, these middle-level jobs, something that's a step beyond minimum wage. And employers there were sort of starting to say, and starting to not even sort of take the GED candidates. They were sort of saying, the GED isn't telling us anything. And that's sort of what was happening at community colleges, too. They were starting to increase the scores required. A pass wasn't always good enough to get into community colleges anymore. The GED felt it needed to respond so that the test alone could be seen sort of as a reliable metric, that if somebody passed this test, they had the equivalent of a high school education.
All right, let's get to your experience. So you sat down for 7 hours to take this test.
Right, and I took it a little bit differently. New York doesn't offer the GED anymore. The state moved to something called the TASK. So I downloaded a test, a practice test, and I didn't look at it until it was time to go. And I closed myself off in my office on Saturday and just sort of set my stopwatch and started working.
And how'd you do?
I did really badly. And I sort of, so I thought that, you know, I'm a writer. I thought that I'd at least do well in the language arts test. The first test is called Reasoning Through Language Arts, and there's a reading test, a grammar test, and a writing test. And that first test, the reading section, I didn't even finish it, and I got 16 out of 40 questions right. And this is sort of what I do for a living.
So that's pretty humbling.
It really is. And part of it's just because it's sort of interacting with a text in a way that outside of high school you really never do. The first essay they gave you to interpret with about 10 questions after it is from the mid-1800s. It's just one 600 or 700-word paragraph by a philosopher on, it's called, got it right in front of me here, The Vision of Sudden Death by Thomas De Quincey. And it is long and hard, and after the test I read it again, and I just really struggled to just get it. And then they ask you to pull apart, what is the main ideas, and what was the main idea, and what are the rhetorical devices that are being used? And I just bombed it.
Well, I don't know how old you are, but it's safe to assume that you're many years, or several years at least, out of high school. So aren't they just testing people who are, you know, just were in high school, and maybe this information is a little fresher in their minds?
I'm 27, so I've been out of high school since 2005. And a lot of the people are not going in completely cold like I am. But I think a lot of the prep teaches you how to take the test and goes over some of the basic skills. But I still hope that my level of reading comprehension hasn't dipped. My ability to take a test is hard, but I struggled in some of these cases just to understand what the texts were about.
And I assume the math went even worse.
That's what I thought was going to be the case, but I didn't do as terribly on the math. I got basically the equivalent of a D minus. I got just over 60% of the questions right. Part of it was they love the Pythagorean theorem here, and I remembered that enough. I can balance an equation just basically. But yeah, I haven't thought about the slope of a line or sort of the area of a cone since I had to do it in geometry algebra. My math at this point is limited to sort of figuring out the tip and splitting bills with my roommate.
Well, you know, this does raise a bigger, more serious question, and that is, what's the relevance of this test if it's testing you on stuff that you don't really need to be a successful adult in a career? I mean, you are a successful adult in a career. You did terribly on this test. So does that mean the GED is pretty meaningless?
That is kind of what it seems like at me. I think, like a lot of these standardized tests, more than anything, the GED just kind of tests how well you did at taking the GED. I think if I went back and studied and went through a study guide, which are available through Pearson along with a handful of other groups, I probably would have done better. I would have just known what to expect. I could have been sort of in that mental state. But they're hoping that it shows high school equivalency. But then the bigger question is, when you're going for these middle skill jobs particularly, or going back to community college, maybe high school equivalency isn't necessarily what you need to show. If you're going to get sort of a machining job or something middle skill, a good job, the kind of thing that people taking the GED want, machining or getting a cosmetology license, something that requires to go back to school just for a little while, I don't think you need to do a close reading or know algebra. Maybe the GED isn't sort of the right metric to even be looking at these things.
So let's say you're an employer and you've got to look at your scores. Would you hire Matt?
I would not hire me. I hope that my own bosses don't sort of change their mind about my employment situation. But
this is your last appearance.
I know, it's been very strange.
On a radio show.
Bouncing around with failing tests all over the internet in the last couple of days.
Well, Matt Collette, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Matt Collette is an education reporter and a radio producer for now in New York. Okay, what do you think? Is a tougher GED a good thing or a bad thing or what? What do you think about it? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, in a hostage situation such as the one in Paris last week at the kosher market, police use flashbang grenades before rushing in. They're effective at disorienting the gunmen, but more often these grenades are used in people's private homes, and sometimes the results are lethal. That story is next after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A flashbang grenade is pretty much what it sounds like. It's a modified grenade that produces a blinding flash of light and a deafening boom. Police use flashbangs to distract and disorient suspects during home raids. But the military-style grenades can severely burn and maim people who are hit by them. And there's little oversight when it comes to who is using flashbangs, when and why. Julia Angwin is senior reporter for ProPublica. She led an investigation into flashbang grenades. Welcome, Julia.
It's great to be here.
Well, how did flashbangs come to be this tool for police departments?
So like many police department tools, they started as a military tool. In the late 70s, the military was dealing with, around the world, kidnappings. I don't know if you remember, there were a lot of plane hostage-taking situations.
Yeah, Patty Hearst.
Right, exactly. And so there were a lot of tools that the military special forces were trying to come up with to figure out a way to sort of stun the people who were holding hostages, but not harm the hostages. So they came up with this idea of taking a grenade, but making it not explode into shrapnel. So just the explosion and the light and sound, but without the sort of devastating results of having all that shrapnel embedding in people's bodies. So they modified grenades to make these flashbangs that are try to mimic the grenade effect and stun somebody who's holding a gun into not being able to move for a few minutes because their sensory overload of being exposed to it.
Well, so that was in the late 70s, but they're still being used now.
So what's happened? Yeah. So what's happened since then is in the late 80s, the SWAT teams came to be in the United States. A lot of police departments, starting with L.A., built SWAT teams, and they wanted to outfit them with the latest tools, and they sought out these flashbang grenades. And at first, they were just built for the military, but industry has arisen to provide them to law enforcement as well. And now they have become a tool that are common and routinely used by SWAT teams across the nation.
But you interviewed the guy who invented the modern version of it, of these flashbangs, and he seems to kind of regret what he did.
I talked to this one manufacturer. He's one of the earliest manufacturers of flashbang grenades, Bill Nixon. He lives near Memphis, and he built some of the first flashbangs. And he had the experience of seeing what happened when people were injured by them. Several officers, police officers, actually lost hands when holding his grenade, and it exploded early, or possibly they released the pin. It's not clear. But either way, people's arms and hands were severed. And he started to believe that the police were treating these devices too casually. They're considered less lethal. And less lethal is a category that includes things like tear gas, sound cannons, also tasers. But as we know, some less lethal things can be fatal. People have, you know, been injured severely and fatally by tasers, and flashbangs as well have turned out to be fatal in some instances. But they need to be treated with the care that something that can cause a fatality or severe injury should be treated. And he came to believe that police officers weren't really trained to do that.
And it's not just the police officers. You detail in your story civilians, people who are oftentimes sleeping in bed, being injured, and in some cases, who die from these flashbangs. Tell us the story of Trenisha Dukes.
So Trenisha Dukes was a 22-year-old woman. She was sleeping over at her boyfriend's apartment. She was actually pregnant. And the police in Clayton County, Georgia, which is near Atlanta, stormed in at 5 a.m. suspecting her boyfriend of being a drug dealer. They threw a flashbang grenade. She says it landed on her body in bed. They say that she ran into the path of the flashbang that they threw. Either way, no one disputes that she was burned second degree across her body severely. She was in the burn unit for 3 days. She suffered scarring, and she was pregnant, so she couldn't take the pain medication that you normally would take for this situation. And she's now suing the police. It's been years, and it's not clear whether she will win. These cases are hard to win. But she is outraged that, you know, what happened was they found a tenth of an ounce of marijuana in this raid, and there was no resistance. If they had knocked on the door and come in and asked to search, they would have complied. And so she believes there was no reason to use excessive force.
And then there's another really heartbreaking story of a baby. The flashbang ends up in a playpen where the baby is sleeping.
Yeah, this story is so sad. I even start crying sometimes when I talk about it. But this is a 19-month-old baby who was sleeping at the foot of his parents' bed in a playpen. And the police stormed into the house once again on a pre-dawn raid looking for a drug suspect who was not in the house and they did not find any drugs in the house, and threw this grenade into the baby's crib. It exploded next to his face. His nose was blown off. His lips and mouth were torn apart. His chest was exposed. His ribs were exposed. He barely survived. He was in a medical coma for almost a month. He's had 8 reconstructive surgeries, and the cost of it has been $1.6 million. The family cannot afford to pay it, and the police department has refused to help out with the medical bills.
This is such a tragic story, and it did get national attention at the time, and so have some other cases. So why haven't these things been reined in? Why haven't they been banned, I guess?
Well, the challenge is that flashbangs do have useful purposes. In Paris, just last week, when they were rescuing those hostages in the kosher supermarket, they use flashbang grenades. They're very useful in hostage situations. And there may well be home raids where they might be necessary. But there's no national law regulating police in this country. We have 18,000 law enforcement agencies at state and local levels. There are no national standards for anything for these departments. They each set their own rules about how they use their tools. And so we have a very decentralized environment. You know, the New York Police Department actually basically stopped using flashbangs after a woman died of a heart attack when they flashbanged her home in a mistaken drug raid, once again in the wrong house. And she died of a heart attack. And they actually issued some rules. There's very strict rules about use of flashbangs in New York. But the departments I looked at in Little Rock and Atlanta were using them on nearly every raid. And so it's up to these departments to make their own decisions about how they want to use them.
Well, as you said, there are other means. Tear gas, for example, which is less lethal or seems to be less lethal. So are they just not considered as effective, these other means?
Well, actually, one thing that surprises me about all of this is I don't really understand why you would need them. Because when you look at what happens during these home raids, and I've examined a lot of the documents, they show up often in an armored vehicle. They're wearing body armor. They're carrying assault weapons, rifles. They are. They have a battering ram to break down the door. They often have special tools for breaking the windows. To be honest, these people are heavily armed who are breaking into these houses. It is not clear to me that you, in addition, need to throw in a grenade, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess their argument is, well, it would prevent a shootout if the suspect does have guns and, you know, can hear people ramming the door and grabs his guns. You know, maybe the flashbang grenade would prevent that from happening.
Right. Although what's interesting about that is we did encounter several cases where the flashbang grenade caused the opposite thing, which is that the smoke and the light confused the officers and they shot the wrong person. So we actually encountered several cases like that where the confusion affects not just the suspects, but sometimes the officers themselves.
And then that was the case of a girl in Detroit, right? A 7-year-old girl.
Correct. There was a 7-year-old girl. She was sleeping on a couch. The police stormed in. They threw in a grenade. It caught her blanket on fire. And then in the confusion, they shot her to death.
So these cases that you've outlined, these three that you've talked about here in this interview, these are outrageous. And has there been any kind of reaction to this in these various police departments where they've thought, okay, let us re-look at this. This is not worth the effort. This is not worth the potential of catching these suspects, the potential loss of life and potential loss of millions of dollars in restitution.
Right. Well, the police departments that I profiled in here in Little Rock and Clayton County that are using them regularly did not express any desire to change their behavior to me. However, what has been really interesting about this reporting is I've heard from a lot of police officers outside of those departments who say, my department is cautious, or I'm really glad you're bringing this to light because I'm concerned about the use of these devices. One thing that is clear is that the number of injuries that I was able to account for nationally is a drop in the bucket. There are very few. I was only able to find the ones that were either reported in the press or had filed a lawsuit. But it is clear from talking to people that these injuries are pretty routine, that people do get hurt a lot. And so I think people in the industry themselves have expressed to me that they're concerned about the overuse of flashbangs.
Julia Engwin, senior reporter for ProPublica, and you can find her investigation into the police use of flashbang grenades at ProPublica.org. Julia, thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up in 15 short minutes from now is To the Point with Warren Olney, and here to give us a preview is the man himself.
I am here by myself, or I should say with you, but on my own.
Are we ever alone?
No, never. Never happens. We're going to talk today. You just were talking about things that ought to be reported that aren't being reported. So are we. We've heard so much about what happened in France, and of course, it's important. Nobody's apologizing or thinking that it's necessarily over coverage. But what about what's happening in Nigeria? What about what's happening in Yemen? Not just in terms of what the consequences might be for the West, but what the humanitarian issues are, and why are people doing what they are doing? In many cases, we make generalizations about terrorism as if everybody's doing it for the same reason. Mm. Well, it turns out that's not true.
So you're going to go and find out what happened with Boko Haram and those
Boko Haram
2,000 people
with
that
Al-Qaeda
were
in Yemen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. 2,000
okay.
people killed.
Amazing. And not that much talked about.
And the use of little children, the 10-year-old girls with explosive devices on them. Mm.
Okay, that's coming up 15 minutes from now, to the point with Warren Olney. Thank you. And speaking of kids, another story altogether, Kidzania, the amusement park for kids who want to pretend they're adults. What happens when playtime becomes work time? That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Imagine a theme park with no rides and no games. Instead of imagining themselves as maybe princesses or pirates, children pretend that they're, well, adults. They can work in offices or factories for the day. They can grocery shop and bank. It might not sound like the most exciting concept, but for some reason, kids seem to love it. It's called Kidzania, and it's a major attraction in more than a dozen countries. And now there are plans to bring Kidzania to the United States. Rebecca Mead went to one in Mexico and wrote about the experience for the latest issue of The New Yorker. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, you went with your son, and how old is he?
He is nine.
He's nine. And so just describe when you came up to the pearly gates of Kidzania. What did it look like?
Well, they're not pearly gates. They are, it's a kind of simulated airplane, your sort of embarkation point. So it's like a ticket counter. You go up and you get a ticket, looks like a real airplane ticket. And the child gets a check for 50 kidzos. Kidzania has its own currency, and they use those kidzos to either do activities that are fun within Kidzania, like renting a car, or they can spend them in one of the gift shops or something like that. And they also earn kidzos with the different activities that they do inside. So yeah, you go up, you get your kidzos, you get a little bracelet snapped on your wrist so they can track you, so they don't lose you, and so they know everything that you've done.
Hmm.
And you go in, and it's kind of cacophonous and riotous and like a little mini city.
And the adults are nowhere to be found?
Well, no, the adults are all there, sort of traipsing around after their children, looking at them through plate glass, because each of the establishments, you know, you can go and make a pizza, or you can go and pretend to be working in a coin minting operation, or those kinds of things. And parents aren't allowed through the doors of those, but they're all plate glass windows, like little pretend storefronts. So there are lots of parents traipsing around, you know, while their children sort of run riot in through the streets.
There's one where kids can actually make hand sanitizer in a factory. Any kid want to do that?
Well, ask Dettol, which is the sponsor for that one, and that, you know, that's really the question here. I mean, these, you know, each of the establishments is sponsored by a real company, and the idea for them is that this is a way that they get access to a consumer at a very young and impressionable age, mm-hmm. and form a bond with them before a kid has even, you know, learned what hand sanitizer is. They know that if they were to want to sanitize their hands, Dettol or whatever would be the brand that they would choose to do it.
Well, the original idea for this theme park came about in Mexico and has now, as I said earlier, spread to all these other countries. How did it come out? Because as we've been saying, it seems like an unusual idea of fun.
Yeah, I mean, it began 15 years ago in Mexico, and there are two of them in Mexico City. It began 15 years ago with the idea that a place that children could go and role play the jobs of adults would be fun and possibly educational, and that at the same time, from the business side, bringing these different sponsors to the kids could be, you know, a profitable way of making money from these various corporate sponsors.
And what are the kids' reactions to this idea that they are play acting as adults?
You know, I talked to children. I went to one in Kuwait City, and it's the most popular destination on TripAdvisor in Kuwait City. If you look, Kidzania is the number one. And I talked to some of the kids there, and they were you know, really thrilled by the idea that this place was theirs, they felt, and that the children, you know, their parents, you know, everywhere else their parents tell them what to do, and here they decide what to do for themselves.
Yeah, and it seems like it's not about fantasy as much as the kind of humdrumness of adult life. It doesn't seem, you know, at least to us who have to live it in real life, that thrilling. Maybe it is to a kid.
But
it's not about creating lands or worlds that are just purely imaginary. It's very based in real life to a kind of dispiriting degree, from what I read in your article.
It's very much not about fantasy, although I'm sure that, you know, kids will go and, you know, kids will make imagination, you know, will use their imagination in all kinds of contexts, you know, so kids will kind of, you know, use their imaginations wherever they are, and I'm sure that there are lots of kids having fun pretending to be the prisoner in the jail because they have a jail cell, and or enacting the role of the DHL delivery guy, which is another very popular pursuit. But what's interesting, I mean, the activities are all highly scripted. So there's a, you know, there are rules that you're supposed to follow. There's a script you're supposed to follow, and there isn't room for deviation from that. So it's not a kind of ideally progressive environment in which children get to explore and invent and create. It really is, you know, in a peculiar way, kind of inducting them into conforming with the rules of corporate capitalism.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because it is a particular worldview, a particular Western worldview, and Kidzanias are all over the world, in the East. And so are there any tensions between this worldview, this Western market-oriented worldview, and different philosophies, different worldviews in different countries that are hosting these Kidzanias?
It's so interesting. I mean, I went to Mexico and I went to Kuwait, but I'm told that in other countries, you know, the behavior of children in different countries varies. So in Mexico, the children apparently earn their money from doing their activities and then spend it immediately. You know, there's no culture of Kidzania saving. Whereas in Japan, Kidzania has a really hard time getting kids to spend any of the money that they've earned. They just want to save it all. When I was in Kuwait, the kids were, you know, collecting vast quantities of kidzos because they were going every day, and they were walking around with, you know, pocketbooks full of like thick wads of notes, which may be, you know, appropriate to a country where the average income is extremely high. So there's, you know, these different behaviors. And then again, you know, there's different cultural practices and mores that Kidzania comes up against. They're about to open in Jeddah, in Saudi Arabia. And there, girls will be allowed to drive the little cars that they have. You know, women in Saudi Arabia are not allowed to drive. Yeah. So this is it's an interesting contrast, and one that they had to, you know, there's a lot of discussion about and debate about, and this is how they decided to go. And, you know, I talked to people there who, you know, hope that this will in some way help to move things forward in a direction that might allow women to drive.
And so when are we going to have this opportunity here in the United States?
You'll have to ask Kidzania that. There's as yet no date of a new Kidzania opening, although they're looking at places, and they've been looking in Chicago and in Texas, locations that they're considering. But nothing has been announced yet.
And I wonder how it would be different for the kids, the American kids, like what they would want to do.
It's funny to see the things that, you know, my kid loved being a DHL delivery guy because it was a good way to make money very quickly, just be paid for, you know, running around the place, bringing one thing to another. I don't imagine that's what he's going to do in his life, although who knows, you know, maybe running around from one place to another, bringing things from one place to another is exactly what he's destined to do. But it was a really fun thing for him to do. He asked me before we went, he was sort of speculating about what kinds of jobs there might be, and he asked whether one could become a writer there, because both his parents are writers, and he was sort of quickly dismissed that idea by saying, oh no, you know, kids don't want to be writers. So you start out being a delivery person at 9, and you know maybe that's what you do, but maybe you do something else later.
So would you go back? Would you want to go back?
Oh, you know, there's one opening in London in a few months' time, and I'm from England. I'm English, and I go back pretty regularly, and it is possible that I will go and check out the one in London. I mean, it's... You know, it would be fun to take my kid there with a bunch of his friends. That won't happen because they don't live in London. But I could imagine them having a blast while I go and sit in the parents' lounge and get a manicure or something like that.
Fantasize about being a kid. Rebecca Mead, staff writer for The New Yorker. She wrote about the theme park Kidzania for the magazine's latest issue. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, we have our own Kidzania right here.
I would love to get a kid in here and pretend to be the feedback producer for Press Play and see what they come up with.
It would be entertaining.
It would be totally entertaining and give me a day off. So we talked about the new version of the GED earlier in the show. The high school equivalency test was redesigned in 2014 and it got a lot harder. But is that a good thing or a bad thing? Ruben Escorsa says on Facebook that he's just happy he took the GED 25 years ago. I'm with Ruben. Do you remember how to work the quadratic formula?
No.
No. I bet if we went on the street.
I can't even help my kids right now.
I know,
with
right?
Homework.
Yeah.
It's pathetic.
Yeah, mommy's busy.
Yes.
JT West Coast made an interesting point. He says that the original GED was supposed to pass people the same way high school does. In other words, D students still graduate. Making it harder kind of defeats the original mission of the test. But Vinny says that we live in a world where all education is being watered down. He came across an elementary school history book from 1909 and says that the material in the book would be taught in college nowadays. The problem isn't that tests are hard, it's that school just isn't tough anymore.
Okay. Lots of opinions out there. You can weigh into Facebook, KCRW Press Play, Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. Thank you, Julie Myers.
Of course.
And coming up in a few seconds from now, Warren Olney. And To the Point, I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.